great Chinese master, Empty Cloud, went to Thailand here, was invited to give a Dhamma talk at the main monasteries in Bangkok. He got up on the Dhamma seat and sat there, went into Samadhi for about a week or so. Sometimes you don't really need to say anything, you know. The teaching's plainly obvious for everyone. So I wonder sometimes what will happen if I sit here at the beginning of a Dhamma talk and nothing comes out. And it really is hard to improve on the Dhamma of silence, isn't it? And silence is what we're listening to when there's nothing to listen to. Silence is the sound that things make when they're still. Silence is the sound that happens when movement ceases, when activity ceases, when everything ceases. And it's an extraordinary thing how sensitive our human mind is, how alert it is, how able we are to be aware of our environment, our context, to make sense of it. To be conscious of it. The human mind is really a sense organ of the most exquisite subtlety, capable of distinguishing between the finest variations in sights, sounds, smells, tastes, touches, capable of instantly and accurately assessing a complex situation and making a decision. Capable of adapting to so many different circumstances, environments. And not only is the mind capable of receiving and being sensitive to its environment, it's also capable of extraordinary constructive and creative work. It can make things, make plans, ideas, imagination. All of the artificial, all of the man-made things we see around us in the world, they all come out of human imagination in some way. What we call life, what we call human life, if we trace the course of a life from birth, growing up and developing and becoming an adult and then experiencing the different phases of life, all of this changes and develops our mind. Our mind grows, learns new capacities, new abilities, new strategies. And of course that process is something that shouldn't be taken for granted. It's so complex, it depends on so many things that it often breaks down and we end up with various kinds of mental problems, psychological or emotional dysfunctions. We all have them to some degree, and of course not infrequently it becomes very disturbing and can prevent our development completely. So the growth and the nurturing of our mind is perhaps the most important task that we undertake in our life. There are many different aspects to this. One way that we use to train our mind and develop our mind, of course, is through education. We want to learn about a particular topic and we go and we learn that topic, but more importantly than learning the content of a topic is learning the methods. We learn how to reason, we learn how to draw inferences, we learn how to find out the information that we need or to problems that are in front of us. As well as these skills, then there's the emotional skills. We call the emotional intelligence and the social skills, understanding how we feel, understanding how we're affected in different contexts, understanding how our thought processes and preferences are informed by and related to our emotions. Understanding how this affects people around us. And learning that certain emotions are helpful and wholesome, and others are destructive and harmful. And our emotions also develop and mature as we get older. We don't have the same reactivity we had when you see young children. They're crying over something that's so tiny, and also laughing and joyful for something so tiny. As we get older, our emotions tend to even out. Well, we don't have the same excitement and joy about things, nor do we have the same anger and sadness about things. It tends to be more even. So part of what we're doing here in this monastery is training these aspects of our mind. In the classes that we hold, we train the our intelligence, we learn things, we inform ourselves, we learn how to discuss and debate, to inquire, to question. We learn how to find out information about those things that are important and relevant for us. And we also have that training in the emotions. It's like learning how to relate to each other with kindness, with understanding, learning how to listen to each other. Learning how to respect each person for who they are, not for what we want them to be or what we can make them. But just to respect and to celebrate, to rejoice in the differences between people, their individual quirks and personalities and so on. It makes life interesting. But more important than these things is the development of awareness. Awareness itself. It's that sense of listening when there's nothing to hear. That watching when everything is darkness. It reminds me of one of my favorite stories from the Upanishads. And you may have heard me telling this story before, but it's one of the dialogues between Yajnavalkya and King Janaka of Mithila. Yajnavalkya, the great sage, had made a deal with King Janaka that he would always answer whatever question that he asked. And so this time the king came to see the sage to ask him questions, but Yajnavalkya didn't feel like talking. He wanted to remain silent, so he tried to fob off the king, not give him the answer that he was looking for. And the king asked him a question, what is a person's light? Remember when we were talking about the Samanipana Sutta, I mentioned that this idea of the light or the lamp is a very potent one in Indian idea. That the lamp is always the guide, that which illuminates, that which dispels the darkness and brings wisdom. And someone asked me this question, King Janaka, who was a very philosophically minded king, He was clearly asking a spiritual question here. What is a person's light? And Janaka's reply was, Yajnavalkya's reply was, it's the sun. The sun is a person's light, because by the light of the sun we can walk out, we can walk back, we can see all the activities that we need to do. And King Janaka said, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. That's a wonderful answer, Yajnavalkya. It's a very profound answer, I'll bear it in mind. But what happens at night time when the sun goes down? What then is a person's light? And Yajnavalkya says at that time it's the moon, because by the light of the moon, even when the sun's not out, we can still see our way around. And Janaka says, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. It's wonderful, it's marvelous, the answer, the wisdom of the great sage. But he said, what happens when the moon is not shining? Sometimes it's the dark phase of the moon and there's no moonlight. What then is a person's light? And Yajnavalkya said, when there's no sun and there's no moon at that time, the stars are a person's light. Because even though the starlight is very dim, but your eyes still get adjusted to it. And even then you can still see your way around at night time. How sensitive our eyes are. that we can see even with such a tiny little bit of light. And Janaka says, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. It's a wonderful answer. You're quite right. And Nivalka, when the sun has set and when there's no moon, then the stars are a person's light. But he said, what happens when the sky is covered with a thick clouds from one end of the horizon to the other? And the stars can't be seen. At that time, what is a person's light? And the Ajahn said, when the sun has set and the moon is not shining and the stars are covered with clouds, then at that time a lamp is a person's light, because we can light a lamp and we can still find our way around. And Janaka said, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. That's a wonderful answer, Ajahn. Once more you answer all my questions fully. But he said, what happens when you don't have a lamp? When the sun has set and the moon is dark and the sky covers and the clouds cover the stars and you don't have a lamp, at that time, what is a person's lamp? What is a person's light? And then Yajnavalkya finally is backed into a corner. He can't get out of this one. And finally he reveals the answer that Janaka was looking for all along. He said, at that time, self is the light. So of course in this Upanishadic literature, the idea of the self being the light, the self is identified with consciousness in the highest sense, of the purified mind. And even though, of course, from a Buddhist point of view, we wouldn't describe that in the same way, we wouldn't talk about a self, but still the Buddha pointed to this idea of the mind being radiant, and the mind being a source of light and a source of wisdom. One of the reasons for that, why I find that particular dialogue so resonant, is because it actually captures that movement of awareness from external to internal, from the most obvious to the most subtle. And it's so true to say that in the daytime, when the light of the sun is shining so brightly, that it's almost like it obscures, the sunlight almost obscures the subtle truths. I'm not sure if you're familiar with the paintings of Turner, who's a great English painter. And this is one of the things that he did in his paintings. He was the first one to use light. He would often paint ships and seaside scenes. And he'd show like that brightness of the light shining off the sea. There's so much light that you can't see things anymore. The light's actually obscuring the objects. It's obscuring things rather than illuminating them. I can relate to that being having grown up in Perth. And in Perth, if you're down on the beach on a summer's day, the water is incredibly bright. It's the sun, the glare off the water and the sand's incredibly white. So it's almost kind of overwhelming, the amount of light that's present. And so that in the daytime, when we have so many things, the external world is so lit up, it draws our attention out. And it's only gradually, as the night falls, those more subtle kind of lights, the inner light, and becomes more apparent. When we have that sense of peace and that sense of stillness in the mind, we look into the mind as it's settling down, and you can see that subtle kind of radiance starting to emerge there. The more pure the mind is, the more that radiance will shine. And it's quite extraordinary, because it does really look like a light. In fact, it's very normal that at certain stages in your meditation you'll be thinking that you'd be sitting there with your eyes closed, and you're thinking that something's happened, someone's turned on a light in the room or something, and you kind of open your eyes to check, because it really just looks so much like actually real light. But that light, of course, is not anything, it's not actual light, it's a perception. It's the way the mind appears to itself as the hindrances are abandoned and as the mind becomes pure. It's a way of seeing or a way of knowing. That's all. It's a metaphor. the mind's describing its own state to itself, and it uses that metaphor of life. And so there's this experience of light, this experience of that incredible sensitivity of the mind that comes in meditation. And when you look into to see what the mind is, and the receptiveness and the softness of the mind in meditation, it's this extraordinary little thing, really. It's like a little baby bunny or something like that. Very incredibly soft and delicate. And it's quite amazing as we look in and we see the softness of this thing, and how our mind is so ephemeral. There's nothing to it. We try to look into our mind, we try to see what actually is there. And the more and more we look in there, the less we can see, the more empty everything becomes, the more open everything becomes. And yet it's precisely that thing which is the most nothing, the most empty, that's also the most powerful. It's quite extraordinary, isn't it? The complexity of the mind, the subtlety of it. There's nothing there. You keep on looking and keep on looking, peeling back layers of understanding, and then you see the way the mind reacts to even the slightest little thing, kind of a little kind of emotional tremor or a reaction to a sense stimulus or kind of an emotional reaction to a memory or something like that, where we hold things in different parts of the body, and you can see every tiny little thing, a tiny little itch, and it's there in the mind, it's imprinted in the mind. All there. And when we can see this, and we become more and more compassionate towards our own mind, more and more respectful of it, more and more careful not to do anything that would hurt it. You realize how dangerous the defilements of the mind are, how easy it is for them to get hold of us, rip our mind to shreds, and then we recoil from those things. The more we see the danger in them, the more we want to recoil from them. We want to recoil from doing anything that would bring harm. And as we meditate and see the softness of the mind like this, the more we see this, the more we're understanding the nature of the mind. And in particular, we're understanding the conditioned nature of the mind. And of course, you have this debate in Buddhism about, is the mind intrinsically pure or not? And some people like to argue that the mind is intrinsically pure, and others point out that the mind, the Buddha pointed it to ignorance and defilements as being the origination of the mind. So which is it? Is the mind intrinsically pure, or is the mind intrinsically defiled? Of course, the answer is neither. The answer is the mind isn't intrinsically anything. The mind's intrinsically conditioned. It's like asking a question, is water intrinsically pure or not? Is water naturally pure or not? It's a meaningless question. How do you want to define water? Do you define water as H2O? If you define water as H2O, then, well, yeah, it is intrinsically pure, it's just H2O. But that's just a verbal, it's just a semantic game, that doesn't mean anything. Water in the real world always comes mixed with things. Even very pure forms of water, like rainwater, still has some things in there. It's not entirely pure, H2O. So the reality is that water, as we experience it and as we find it in the world, always has something. So to talk about whether water is naturally pure or naturally polluted is really just a word game. Actually, what we see in the world is that water is always affected by its surroundings and its environment. And if we want to understand why the water is like this in one particular place or not, then we have to understand what that context is. And using the simile of water is not an arbitrary one, but it's one of the basic similes that the Buddha used for the mind is affected by the five hindrances. And water, like the idea of light, water also has this incredible only this combination of clarity and softness. Anything that you do to water, it will have its effect. It always reverberates, just like the mind does. And so the Buddha said that the five hindrances are like water in different states. The hindrance of sense desire is like water that's brightly coloured. So you put a bright blue dye or a bright red dye into the water and make it look beautiful. It's like the mind filled with sensual desire. And the mind with ill will is like water which has been heated, boiling water, bubbling. And sloth and torpor is like water that's like brackish, it's got weeds growing in it and it's covered with slime and scars and so on. You can't, it's all kind of overgrown, there's no life to it. And the restlessness and remorse is like water that's whipped up by a strong wind. We're lashing waves on the surface of the water. And water characterized by doubt is water that's placed in a dark place. There's no light, you can't see into it. So again, the question is water naturally pure, or is it naturally in all these different kind of states? And of course the answer is it's naturally conditioned. It's naturally changing. So our mind is naturally conditioned by what we do to it, by how we behave with our mind. It's not like anything, it's not one way or the other. It's changing, it's conditioned. So this is what we mean when we talk about the emptiness of the mind. When we're meditating, we see the, when we try to meditate, we try to make our mind peaceful, we try to get this clarity of mind. We hear these words, this talk of the peace of the mind and the clarity and the happiness and so on, and it's very attractive. We want to move our mind in that direction, and so we have kind of set up a duality because of that. We want to be happy and yet we're not. We want to be peaceful and yet we're agitated. And so there's a certain dukkha that's involved in there, and that's a natural part of that process. But that's like on the samadhi level. On the wisdom level, the wisdom comes from understanding precisely the fact that the mind changes. Understanding precisely the fact that sometimes it is peaceful and sometimes it isn't. Understanding precisely the fact that sometimes we are happy and sometimes we're not happy. So while on a samadhi level, we can say, yeah, the samadhi's working or not working, or that was a good meditation or bad meditation or something like that. But on a wisdom level, if we're always reflecting about this and seeing the way the mind changes in different circumstances, then we have that, and then no matter what happens, whether it's good meditation or bad meditation or whatever, then we still have the wisdom is growing, the understanding is growing, little bit by little bit by little bit. So we should never feel that our effort is wasted. We should never feel that somehow that, you know, that meditation was a waste of time, or it was a mistake, or did it wrong, or something like that. That's how you learn. You try things out. Figure out why it works sometimes and why it doesn't work other times. That's your wisdom, and that's how your wisdom grows. And it's very often that your wisdom, you learn much more about things by getting your hands dirty, by getting down in there and actually doing it rather than learning about it in abstract. So there's only a limited amount that we can get from teaching and guidance and encouragement in meditation. It's something to help, it's something to encourage us and get us moving in the right direction. But that's only maybe 5% of the job. The rest of the other 95% is up to you. And the process is just nothing more than meditating, seeing what's there, looking into your mind and always striving to understand, what is my mind? What is this? What's going on? And if it comes to the day that we pass away, we're lying on our deathbed, and if that's the only thing we've done with our life, then I think that's a life well spent. If we've come to some understanding of ourselves and our minds, if we come to that final moment in our life and we're dying, which may be today or it may be in many years' time, and if we haven't come to any understanding of ourselves, what kind of life is that? as we learn and understand things, it's not always going to be easy. We're going to learn things about ourselves which are unpleasant, which we're going to want to turn away from. So we have to have some courage. We have to have some sense of intrepidity, of fearlessness. Because as long as the mind is not yet bright, as long as there's a darkness in the mind, then we're facing the unknown, aren't we? We're facing that source of the confusion and depression and anxiety is there, the darkness in the mind. And even though that light oftentimes will seem very feeble, it's like a little candle in the thick blackness of the night, but still it's there, it never goes out completely. It's one of the secrets. That light will never go out completely, no matter how dark things go, no matter how black things are. There's always some little spark of light there. And so by paying attention to that, by nurturing it and growing it, that's gradually how we dispel all the darkness. So this is my little talk for you this evening, and I offer this to you for your reflection. And I'd like to invite if there's any comments or questions. If there's no questions, we'll finish up by paying respects to the Tripitaka.